This podcast is for informational purposes only and does not constitute legal, tax, investment, financial, or other advice. It is not intended to cause or induce breach of an existing agency agreement.
Hello?
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 This is the Vancouver Real Estate Podcast.
And welcome back to Vancouver Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Scalina.
And I'm your other host, Matt Scalina.
And Matt's just a host, but also realtors with Oakland Realty. And super excited for today. We've got Sam Atkins. He's a lawyer practicing in Vancouver. Coming back on the show to talk about the Cowichan decision and land claims more now on the kind of macro level across Canada. And also update us on what's happened kind of since the Cowichan decision.
Yeah, well, there's been some new court cases on the East Coast that kind of changed the dynamics. I feel like since he's been on in early December, a lot's happened at the provincial level. This is kind of fast moving, even though these things usually take years to kind of play out. So it was such a popular episode the first time around. Everybody, the comments we got about the way Sam explained things and his insights, we thought we have to get him back on. And this one doesn't disappoint. It is an update that everybody's waiting for.
Yeah, no, I definitely can't wait for this episode. It's a great conversation. Before we get to that, Matt, of course, we have the segment that remains nameless.
We do, Adam. And I have a question for you this week. Not so much Vancouver real estate. It's who is in the Super Bowl this Sunday? Which two teams are in the Super Bowl?
Are you kidding me?
This is one, man. That you are not going to get. I don't want to put you on the spot.
Oh, man, that's the only...
It's very easy. This is a... Bad Bunny's playing... We know you know Bad Bunny's playing the halftime.
Yeah.
But who is actually in the football game?
Oh, man, this is like... You're like... This is the most embarrassing... You've put me on the spot here.
Before we get to that, Adam, before we get to you quickly Googling who is in the Super Bowl.
I only know one of the two teams.
I wanted to highlight one of our new listings, Adam, because this one is great. 101 1864 Francis Street over at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. Listen to this. We just had a listing across the street from this. This is basically at Francis and Victoria, not even a block to Boza Foods. This is just across the street from Boza Foods, which is dangerously close. A one bedroom garden. Patio, recent updates, great little unit in a rain-screened building, new windows, new patios, nothing to worry about here. And here's the best part, Adam. If you're a first-time home buyer, it's the price. $448,000 is the asking price. Check it out at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. This is obviously first-time home buyers or investors, I think this is a very exciting offering. And we're open on Sunday, Super Bowl Sunday, 1 to 2, so everyone can get home before the Super Bowl. Check it out at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com where you can see all of our listings. But back to the question at hand, Adam.
I feel like next week's question is going to be, can you grow facial hair? talk about a put me on the spot and undress me here.
You can guess.
Well, here I'll tell you the team I know.
Okay,
I do. No. I'm not. I'll tell you. I know that the Seattle Seahawks are one team. So I'm gonna go here, but I'll make a guess. Oh boy. Who's Mahomes on?
I think it's Mahomes with an
Mahomes. N. No, he's my Mahomes. He's my Mahomie. That was my joke, Matt. Come on. Who's Mahomes? Okay. What is he on? Oh man, I don't watch football.
I'm asking questions.
I got 50% right, I think. I know the Seahawks are on it.
Okay. All right.
And I'm watching. I'm heading out on Sunday, so it'll be good.
Yeah. Yeah. No, you know what? I that was actually an audible. I did have another question, and it was about early February, because here's an interesting thing I just wanted to point out. I've been really tracking these daily stats, which is, you know, I you know, 1 month doesn't make a trend. A couple of days doesn't basically tell you much. But one thing that is interesting, Adam, is I have been calling on properties over the last couple of days, and I've been getting a lot of agents telling me stuff has accepted offers, which is something new and kind of surprising. I feel like literally of six properties I spoke to agents about yesterday, I think three or four of them had accepted offers. So it's kind of screwing up the tours. Anyway, I did check.
And I was in multiples twice last week. So yeah, no.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. Like I said, January was the slowest month in 3 years. In the first couple days of February, though, we are outpacing sales from last year. So last February, it was basically 65 sales a day. We're just over 72 sales a day for early February. Like I said, no trend there, but I literally went and checked that out yesterday after having to give disappointing news to buyers about properties being unavailable to view because they had accepted offers. So something interesting to watch.
Yes.
But yeah, let's...
The only other thing I was going to mention is, I think you've flagged this, but Andrew Liss kind of essentially called it a nothing burger, the January stats, right? Like he thinks it was more of... So, I mean, hey, are we... A lot of people, there is more optimism about this year based on who I'm talking to, based on... I went to the Canucks game with folks from Scotiabank a couple weeks back, and lots of optimism around the market, like being a stronger year for transactions, kind of in a lot of banks are feeling like this could be a better year. And a lot of economists, Canadian economists, are saying this could be a bit of an uptick. So I wonder if we're just getting a late start to the year. But anyways, TBD, Matt, just TBD. Like TBD, who are the Seattle Seahawks playing? I'm going to have to Google that afterwards and buy a jersey before Sunday. So let's let's cut to the conversation with Sam.
Let's get to something we do know about, and that's real estate and Sam Adkins talking about the Cowichan decisions and some significant updates since we had him on in December 2025. Enjoy.
Attention realtors, homebuyers, and investors. If you missed out on Atlin at Clayton Crest by Zentera Developments, here's your second chance.
Atlin sold 80% in just 3 months, Adam. And because of that success, Zentera is launching Building 2, Butte.
Located in West Clayton and walking distance to the future SkyTrain station, prices are still low for now, but not for long.
Homeowners across the Lower Mainland are using equity from their current homes to invest in West Clayton, ahead of the SkyTrain and the next market upswing. Because when that SkyTrain is complete and the market rebounds, it'll be too late.
This, Matt, is how wealth is built. Find out why Atlin sold so fast and register now at buttecondos.ca. That's B-U-T-E condos.ca.
Hi, I'm Michael Yu.
And I'm Morgan Brown. And we're the founders of Oakland Realty. We have 9 offices across British Columbia,
serving all major markets of BC. If you're an agent out there, just like Adam and Matt, who happen to be licensed at Oakwin, please reach out to us at oakwin.com/join and type into that message box, the rep, and you'll receive a free gift and a promotion when you meet one of our leaders.
Thanks so much. And we're looking forward to meeting with you.
See you soon.
Okay, so we're here with Sam Adkins. He is a lawyer practicing in Vancouver. Sam, thanks for taking the time. We should also say past guest fan favorite. Welcome back.
Hey, thanks a lot, guys. Thanks for having me on again.
Yeah, fan favorite. You really, the comments section lit up in YouTube based on your provocative claims from last time, Sam.
I laughed because I always thought this was an audio thing. I didn't expect to be on YouTube. So thanks for that, guys.
Well, if it's anything, it's not. You didn't quite reach the success that I had on TikTok that resulted me in the fetal position on the couch crying for a week. But don't go on TikTok was the was the lesson there. Sam, can you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, sure. So You know, like you said, I'm a lawyer practicing in Vancouver. I do a lot of work in the natural resources space. So lots of mining projects, energy projects, LNG pipelines, that type of work, primarily in BC, but I do work across Canada as well. And then as part of my practice, I give a lot of advice on Aboriginal law issues related to Section 35, the duty to consult, the UN Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous People. And so, you know, obviously following some of the decisions around Aboriginal title, like Cowichan and the most recent one from the East Coast.
So, Sam, we had you on near the end of 2025 to talk about the Cowichan decision right when it kind of broke. And for people that missed that conversation, can we maybe just summarize, and people should go back and either watch or listen to that episode, but can we just summarize the Cowichan decision and why it was so both in the Lower Mainland, British Columbia, and also in Canada, and potentially beyond, I guess.
Yeah, no problem. So I guess maybe at the outset, I'd say, you know, I'm trying to, these are complicated decisions. The Cowichan decision itself is like a 900-page decision. It was in court for 500-plus days. My goal, I guess, is to try and give people information about what are these decisions about in kind of as neutral a terms as I can. So the Cowichan decision, of course, it's attracted a lot of attention. It is about Aboriginal title, which is a form of Aboriginal right, which is protected under our Constitution Act through a provision called Section 35. And it's Aboriginal title that has been declared by a court to exist over private lands. And they're private lands in the city of Richmond along the banks of the Fraser River, where the Cowichan tribes, which is a collection of First Nations, primarily situated on Vancouver Island and on the Vancouver, on the Gulf Islands, it had historically established a summer village site. And, you know, in our last episode, we talked a lot about the law around Aboriginal title and that, but suffice for these purposes, you know, they were able to show that they met the test for Aboriginal title. And the test for Aboriginal title is effectively that an Aboriginal group had sufficient occupation of a certain set of lands as at the time of the assertion of Crown sovereignty. So it's the idea that historically, you know, there was a group that occupied those lands. And by sufficient, I just mean sort of in sort of a normal sense, but from a legal perspective, it's really about exclusivity of that occupation. So control, exercising the ability to keep other people out of that land is really what the test is for Aboriginal title. So they were able to show that. And what is different about Cowichan is that we've had Aboriginal title claims in Canada previously, but usually you're talking about provincial crown land, public lands. We're not talking about impacts on private property interests. And in the case of Cowichan, this is sort of the first time that a court has actually dealt with the question of, well, what do you do when you have an Aboriginal group that can show that they have Aboriginal title, at least as at the time of the assertion of crown sovereignty? But now today, those lands are private. They're held by third parties, right? So this is the first effort of a court trying to deal with the issue. And I'm sure we'll talk a bit more about it, but there's been a lot of, you know, fallout in media attention as a result of that decision over the last number of months.
So maybe it's worth kind of talking about the last couple of months, right? Because we had you on in early December. We're now in early February. I feel like the, you know, I was going to say hand-wringing, but hand-wringing is maybe a pejorative. Like, there was a lot of uproar. There was a lot of people saying, calm down. This is not that big of a deal. I feel like David Eby has, well, a lot has happened since. Maybe you've been following along. What has happened and how have things shifted since we talked last?
So one of the things I think, you know, I talked a lot about last time you had me on was these decisions, they take time for people to kind of distill them down and sort of figure out, what do we think about the decision, right? So from a legal perspective, I think that's been happening. There's been a lot of, I think, different lawyers that have been speaking about the decision, some very critical, some saying, well, it's not, you know, this guy's not following, et cetera. What I think has happened over the last number of months, first of all, this is, you know, it's a lower court decision. It's the first sort of court level of court making a decision in respect to this issue. It's under appeal. It's being appealed. But in the meantime, what also has happened is because of the history of the decision, there was a decision early on procedurally for the court not to notify third parties about the decision, about the litigation. And what that was all about was that the court was saying, look, at this moment in time, the Cowichan are not seeking a remedy against private lands. And so we're not going to complicate the litigation by telling third parties about it, because there were potentially, you know, a large number of private parties that would therefore have to respond in some way to that notice that was to be given. So that was a decision taken by the court. They sort of, you know, looked at it, but on balance, they said it'd be more prejudicial than not to tell, you know, private landowners in the claim area about this. So obviously that's been a key focal point. I think people were, you know, very upset to learn that they hadn't been notified by the court about it. Obviously, you know, the province, City of Richmond, Canada, they could have notified landowners anyways. There was nothing stopping it, but they weren't part of the litigation. So one of the things that actually has happened is one of the major commercial landowners in the claim area, Montrose Properties, apparently had one of their developments stalled as a result of the decision, has actually applied to reopen the decision at the sort of lower court level. Very unusual circumstance for them to seek to do that, but the province and the federal government are supporting that application. And the intent behind it is for Montrose to be able to argue and demonstrate that there's a significant prejudice to them as a third-party landowner in the claim area to the court. So that is playing out in real time. And separate from that, you know, depending on where that goes, there'll ultimately be an appeal of the decision to the BC Court of Appeal. So that is playing out separately. And I'm sure you guys have, you know, been hearing questions about it as well. But, you know, there's a lot of people that are sort of waking up to these issues, that are asking questions. Lenders, for example, different, you know, investors and people across Canada are starting to sort of ask questions a lot about, well, what is Aboriginal title? What exactly does it mean? And how does it fit with private land? So there's a lot of sort of that happening as well. And obviously, you know, continues to be concerns around obtaining financing for, you know, mortgages and renewals and projects and things like that within the claim area. BC, of course, announced an insurance scheme to kind of try and address some of those concerns. And so those are the types of things that have been happening over the last couple of months.
The Montrose kind of move to challenge at a lower court. Why, you know, without being a lawyer, why at a lower court? It's not an appeal, it sounds like. And can you kind of walk through that process of how that's presumably the most effective way to approach it?
Yeah, I mean, I don't act for Montrose. I'm not privy to sort of, you know, their approach. At the end of the day, I think what Montrose's position would be is that this decision, that it was a mistake not to have notified third-party private landowners, that in granting a declaration as the court did, of Aboriginal title over private fee simple lands within the claim area, that there is real prejudice to third parties as a result of that. And so Montrose is looking to try and put that position in front of the court to obtain some additional guidance or remedies associated with that. So again, highly unusual. I can't speak to whether they will be successful or not, but that is what is currently happening in, as it relates to that litigation.
And just thinking about that, it's not challenging kind of it's challenging kind of part of the procedure, right? Like, say if they're successful, this doesn't change the legal landscape, except that there was kind of a procedural element that was not done correctly.
Well, and so they would be, I mean, I think when we talked about it in detail last time, one of the things I think I talked about is the court, a lot of what's picked up in the media is that the court invalidated certain titles, right, as a result of the declaration of Aboriginal title within this area. But they only invalidated the titles that are held by governments. So it was the city of Richmond, and the fee simple properties are held by Canada, Government of Canada, in connection with the Vancouver Fraser Port Authority. What the court didn't do, and this is sort of a critical point, is the court didn't say that private landowners other than governments within the Aboriginal title area It didn't do anything to those titles. It just said, you know, we've got private lands over here. We've got now a declaration of Aboriginal title over here. That's where this litigation ended. It didn't seek to try and resolve that clear conflict, right? You have an exclusive right to land over here and an exclusive right to land over here. The court just said, we have these two things. It is the job of the provincial government as the provincial crown to resolve this issue, right? And presumably through negotiation of some type to resolve those types of things. So that's what the court did. The challenge, of course, is the court, while it didn't do anything, like it didn't change that situation, is that that's had real implications, right? The uncertainty that's been created around this sort of floating declaration of Aboriginal title over these private lands has made it very difficult for people within the claim area that own feasible lands. And so Montrose, I would expect, would be trying to get some additional guidance from the court around the impact of that declaration of Aboriginal title over their lands. So, you know, we talked a bit about this last time. There's a bunch of different sort of ways in which these issues could resolve themselves. We should talk a bit about the New Brunswick Court of Appeal decision because they've gone an entirely different direction with this issue. But like I say, there are different ways for this issue to get resolved. And, you know, I expect that Montrose is looking to try and rectify that through the lower court.
Yeah. Can we unpack how New Brunswick is dealing with it completely differently?
Yeah. So again, last time we talked about this, Cowichan, I explained, you know, under appeal, go to the BC Court of Appeal, presumably ultimately ends up in the Supreme Court of Canada. And you'll want guidance from the Supreme Court of Canada ultimately on this question of like, how does private land interact with Aboriginal title claims? And we talked a bit about some of the different ways this could resolve itself at various levels of court. What's happened in New Brunswick? So in New Brunswick, there is an Aboriginal title claim brought by the Wolastoqe Nations over the western half of New Brunswick. And so New Brunswick is, we talked a little bit last time about sort of historic treaties and areas without treaties, and BC doesn't mostly have treaties. In New Brunswick, there and across the Maritimes, there's what's known as the Peace and Friendship Treaties. And those are treaties that were entered into with the British Crown sort of in the 1700s, latter part of that century. And those treaties, though, they don't deal with surrender of lands or anything like that. They were sort of more like alliance type treaties. And so there is a similar issue in New Brunswick and the Maritimes around these questions about Aboriginal title. And so this claim has been advancing through the New Brunswick courts. This is actually a procedural issue. So what happened is the Wolastoqe Nations, they brought a claim of Aboriginal title over a huge portion of New Brunswick. And within that claim, what they did is they identified provincial lands, crown lands, over which Aboriginal title is alleged to continue. They also included a bunch of private lands. And those private lands, they kind of bifurcated into two. One was sort of like residential properties owned by small private landowners, right? And the other category was large industrial owners of land. So like big, you know, sort of corporate industrial users of land. And they called those the industrial land users. And so what they did in that case is Wolastoqe sort of acknowledged the challenge of trying to you know, get a declaration of Aboriginal title over private lands of small private landowners. And so what they said is they weren't looking for a declaration of Aboriginal title. They were seeking what they called a finding of Aboriginal title for the sole limited purpose of being able to pursue like a damages compensation claim against the provincial government, right? So that's sort of what they were looking for, except for the industrial users. So these industrial land users, large, you know, corporate landowners, they were actually seeking a declaration of Aboriginal title over those lands with the idea that perhaps one of the remedies, among others, could potentially be that they might seek a return of those lands. So that's the way they approached the case. On a procedural issue, there's this idea that you can, there's a bunch of procedural things that happen in this litigation before you actually get to a final decision. The private industrial landowners effectively sought to strike out the claims against them as private landowners, saying that they shouldn't be part of this litigation at all. They shouldn't be named as defendants. There shouldn't be a possibility of Wolastoqe obtaining a declaration over their private lands. So what happened at the lower court level? The court accepted the idea that they weren't proper parties to this litigation. That Wolastoqe could only bring these claims against the crown. But what is interesting is they allowed the idea of like, well, perhaps there's still an opportunity for some sort of declaration over the industrial user's land and blah, blah, blah. So that was a couple of years ago. That was sort of declared as a big win, part of Wolastoge, in the sense that they could still pursue this Aboriginal title claim over the industrial user's land. What happened just after we spoke, not that long after, before the end of last year, was the New Brunswick Court of Appeal. This was appealed to the New Brunswick Court of Appeal. The New Brunswick Court of Appeal said, absolutely not, right? You cannot seek a declaration of Aboriginal title over private lands, like full stop, right? And so the court effectively, and this is a higher level court, right? This is a higher level court. It'd be like going in front of the BC Court of Appeal. And the court said that no, the only sort of remedy, it's not only is it not appropriate for the industrial land users to be part of this claim, it is not appropriate for a court to seek a declaration of Aboriginal title over the private lands of the industrial land users. And so what the court said is basically, for the purposes only of this litigation, you can kind of do what you were proposing to do over the small landowners' lands, which is you can seek a binding of Aboriginal title for the sole and exclusive purpose of trying to obtain compensation from the Crown, right? So that, and so nobody's private lands are going to be affected by this. It was a very strong decision, and I'll read you a quote for what it's worth, because Adam, you asked a very like good question last time about how does this all play out for reconciliation. And what the court says is, a declaration of Aboriginal title over privately owned lands, which by its very nature gives the Aboriginal beneficiary exclusive possession, occupation, and use, would sound the death knell of reconciliation with the interests of non and Aboriginal Canadians. And so there's quite a bit of this language in the decision. And that's sort of where the court went with it. So as you can sort of project, you'd say, well, you've got a court of appeal in New Brunswick saying entirely the opposite thing of what Cowichan has done. And I'm not saying it's right, Cowichan's wrong or anything like that. The point being is that the courts have reached very, very different conclusions on the same issue.
So can we talk about the relationship between the courts in New Brunswick and British Columbia for people who, yeah, you know, aren't legal scholars and don't follow along? What is the relationship? What does it mean?
So a New Brunswick Court of Appeal decision, because it's an appellate level court, it's an important decision, and a BC court, for example, would take it into account as being potentially persuasive authority because it's an appellate level court, but it's not sort of binding in BC, right? It's not like a lower court or the court in BC can still come to a different conclusion because they are not sort of bound by decisions of the New Brunswick Court of Appeal. So again, you know, ultimately where this all needs to go is to the Supreme Court of Canada. And only when you get to the Supreme Court of Canada would you have like a precedent, a case, a decision that would actually apply across the country. And now courts are sort of bound by that decision. So to maybe reverse back to some of the discussion we had last time, what will be interesting, Wolastoge has said they will appeal the case. To my knowledge, they have not. Yet you have to seek leave to the Supreme Court of Canada. It may well be that Wolastoge is on a faster trajectory to get in front of the Supreme Court of Canada than perhaps Cowichan is now. Although we'll see what happens there, but it's just a flag to sort of say, you know, this is another case that is proceeding through courts, and these issues are going to end up in front of the Supreme Court of Canada at some stage.
Timelines, Sam, is the uncertainty around this? Are we 2 years out? Are we 6 months out? Are we 5 years out? Where are we?
I had the same question.
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, it depends a little bit on what happens with the New Brunswick Court of Appeal decision. But if Wolastoge does in fact appeal and leave is granted by the Supreme Court of Canada, you might be something like 1 to 2 years out, right, from getting a decision. It may be that the Supreme Court of Canada doesn't grant leave or find some reason not to it. There's a bunch of different potentials here, right? But you know, something of the order of that magnitude of time frame, I would think.
Sam, we keep hearing in our kind of networks that there's some concern in the real estate development community around the Cowichan decisions that seems to be kind of growing. And I just wanted your take on if the concern is warranted and if you feel like things have escalated in terms of, I guess, stakeholders involved in private land since we last spoke.
I mean, I think there's a growing awareness of these issues. And I think we talked last time, like if you're in the resource sector and you are developing a mine or a pipeline or LNG, like you know about this stuff. You understand Section 35, you understand the law, you understand sort of the incremental changes in the law over time. I think, you know, with some exceptions, most in the real estate development world or in the lending world, you haven't really encountered the issues in the same way. So I think there's a growing awareness of the issues. And so I think that is certainly the case. I think there is a knee-jerk reaction of people to want to say, this is just a BC problem, right? This is something weird. BC is weird. It's got strange rules and history and all that. The reality is that Aboriginal title claims exist across the country, right? And so New Brunswick is a good example. There's an Aboriginal title claim, for example, between Montreal and Quebec City, right? Like there are Aboriginal title claims across the country. This is relevant everywhere. And so I think I'd say that. The second piece is there is a lot of sort of confusion between Cowichan, which is a Section 35 constitutional law case as it relates to Aboriginal title. There's confusion about that versus the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, right? Which is a international instrument that BC and Canada in particular have adopted into law. And there's actually another case called Gahala that was of the BC Court of Appeal recently. And there's a bit of mixing of issues, right? UNDRIP, our legislation in BC, those are all things that the government put in place, right? And there has been a reaction to UNDRIP and the DRIPA legislation we have here. If you're following this issue, like provinces said that they will amend the DRIPA legislation to deal with some of the concerns around the Gatlin decision that I just mentioned. Totally separate from Cowichan, right? And so I think there's just a bunch of things that this is a difficult, complicated, nuanced area of law. And I think there's just an increasing awareness of it and concern about, at least from some sectors, about what this means for the economy and for, you know, development in general. So all that says, do I think it's not justified? No. I mean, I think people's concerns are real and there are real impacts from these types of things. But I think a lot of the concern is born out of just a lack of awareness about, like, this is a new thing, right? And I think there's, you know, it is real concern, but there is a broader context for how these things kind of arise and how courts are probably going to approach them.
So the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, I feel like you kind of just spoke to this, but just to be clear, and maybe it's politics, but my impression was David Eby's kind of wearing some of this as like, you know, not a lot of foresight in enacting a lot of the legislation that's been enacted over the last 5-6 years. But it sounds like Cowichan would have happened. Is that what you're saying? That Cowichan is outside of, you know, whatever you think of some of the legislation that's happened over the last 5 years in BC specifically.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So, that litigation started before BC adopted the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples and would have come anyways. Now, there's some interaction. We talked a bit about last time BC didn't argue, for example, unilateral extinguishment of Aboriginal title. And they didn't argue that in large part because of UNDRIP, because they said, well, we won't make these types of arguments anymore. Canada also, you know, said they wouldn't make those types of arguments anymore. Now, there's other reasons BC didn't argue it. I mean, constitutionally, there's a question from a division of powers perspective whether they could unilaterally extinguish anyways. But back to your question is, yeah, absolutely. Cowichan happens regardless of UNDRIP, right? Like that is pure Section 35 litigation. We've had 50 plus years, like since the Calder decision in 1973 around Aboriginal title ownership issues in Canada. That issue is not going away.
I'm just thinking because of some of the comments that I've read around the individual judge who made the ruling in the Cowichan Chase case. How important is the judge in a situation like this? And was the decision surprising in your mind? Or is, like, can it be chalked up to an individual's handling of this case?
Well, I don't want to suggest that Cowichan is wrong, right? Like my goal at the outset is just to give people information about these decisions and not have to take sort of positions if I can avoid it. Every court case involves individuals, right? So the lawyers that are arguing the case, the people that are sitting on the bench hearing the case, the evidence that's put forward, like all of those are individuals and they're all going to bring their own sort of biases and perceptions to things. So that's always the case. the New Brunswick Court of Appeal will have brought their own perceptions to things, right? And so, you know, that is always the case. One judge might decide something a certain way, another one might be more persuaded by something else. And so I think, you know, again, if I go back to the one strength of our system is you can get decisions that are different, but, you know, there's a distillation process, right? So we have a lower court making a decision. People say, well, we don't like this part of it or that part of it. We should appeal on that. And a court of appeal is going to consider more refined arguments, right? They're going to say, well, okay, somebody has digested just volumes of information over a long, long period of time, come to a decision on complicated issues. Now we can refine the issues to, like, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 or 10, right, that we're actually going to consider sort of legal arguments on. And then that can get further distilled as you go to the Supreme Court of Canada. So the idea of our system is not, it shouldn't just be one individual that has a particular perception on something that's the decision for all time. We have processes in place to kind of make sure we try and get it right.
Yeah. And hopefully I didn't frame it like right or wrong. I was more so meaning like if we're seeing different provinces deal with it differently. So we're seeing kind of different trajectories come out of similar claims, right?
Yeah, that's right. So one of the interesting things about the Wolastoggia decision is that this idea of a finding of Aboriginal title versus a declaration of Aboriginal title, which is a pretty nuancy issue, was actually framed in the original litigation, right? As a way of trying to avoid what is clearly a political issue around Aboriginal title impacting on private landowners, right? So the nation, in crafting their claim, created this, and the court went with it. They said, well, you know, so it's kind of interesting. The facts are different in that case, but the underlying principles are the same. And so again, until you have sort of guidance of the Supreme Court of Canada that would apply nationally, it's difficult to know how courts are going to react to this in specific circumstances.
Sam, you're not on the Supreme Court of Canada yet.
Never.
We don't want to ask you to speculate, but obviously this New Brunswick decision is impactful. You know, it was very clear in its findings. How do you think, best guess, how does this get sorted out when it does?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think I said last time, and I have said all along, and when I talk about this decision, even before Cowichan, because this issue was there, people knew it was there, I think it's very unlikely that courts are going to be comfortable with saying there is no remedy for a historical injustice, right? So if an Aboriginal group has been displaced from the land, right, to an area that they lived, right? I think a court's going to be uncomfortable displacing that, but equally, I think they'd be very uncomfortable with having effects of that on private landowners. And, you know, we talked a bit about reconciliation last time. I just read the New Brunswick Court of Appeal statement on reconciliation. Like, it's going to be very difficult for people to support reconciliation as an objective if it means, you know, what Cowichan could mean. And Cowichan didn't say people are going to be displaced, but that's certainly a potential outcome. So I think the courts are going to focus on remedy here, and I don't know if it's going to be quite as stark as the New Brunswick Court of Appeal. There may be a lot of nuance around it, but I think the courts are going to focus more on the idea that this is a compensation type claim against the Crown, or an obligation on the Crown to try and resolve through negotiated settlement, maybe some lands over here, some money over here, you know, ways of like providing some sort of restitution for this historic wrong. I think that's going to be more the focus, and perhaps where the courts ultimately go. But like I say, there's a lot of things in these decisions, lots of smart people arguing different positions. So we will see where it goes.
And maybe as a final question, Sam, what are you keeping an eye on in the coming months, or what are you kind of monitoring, I guess, and things to kind of think about moving forward?
Well, definitely monitoring to see where both this litigation in New Brunswick and this litigation in BC goes. So obviously closely watching that, I suppose, like everybody watching, to see where the province goes in terms of amending the DRIPA legislation. They've publicly stated that they intend to do so. And so that will be a significant piece to this. And then I think, you know, more broadly writ large, it's just a question of, you know, I've said last time, these are important societal issues. I don't think we want to lose sight of them. But we've also got a neighbor to the south, and we've got a threat, and we've got an economy that we need to be thoughtful about as well. And so I think it'll be interesting to sort of see how these different forces kind of play out over the next year or so.
And you know what, just as a final thought, that was going to be my last question. Basically, is there situations where things are fast-tracked? Because it strikes me the uncertainty here in this current political and economic environment is very damaging. So does this get pushed ahead quicker, or is it just like, no, these things take time and let's see how it plays out?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think on the sort of litigation side of things, I don't think there's sort of a fast-tracking sort of process, with the exception being if Montrose is successful in reopening the case, right? That'll be sort of interesting to watch. But certainly more broadly speaking, and if I think more to my own practice and the types of projects I work on, fast tracking, streamlining, trying to get things through processes quicker is for sure a focus of the provincial, federal, and actually, frankly, many provincial governments to try and move things through to make sure that we are maintaining our economy. But I don't think they're going to do that to the detriment of reconciliation or relationships with Indigenous peoples. Like, you know, I work all the time in this sector. First Nations in BC are as focused on the economy and wanting to make sure that development is happening, you know, in ways that make sense for their communities. And so I continue to believe that there are ways for us to work together to get things advanced in a way that makes sense for all of us. But I do think we'll see more of an effort on, can we do things more quickly, please?
Makes a lot of sense.
Well, Sam, unless you've read a bunch of books over the holidays, I don't know. Do we have...
Rapid fire.
Right. One book you've read recently, and it can't be The Company.
Yeah, okay. a little less serious. I'm reading Michael J. Fox's book about making Back to the Future. It's awesome. Like, if you like Back to the Future, and he's talking about trying to do it while he was filming Family Ties at the same time, and he slept for like 3 hours a night, and it's like a crazy book. So if you love that movie, and I love that movie, it's a great book to read, and kind of a nice, you know, local, you know, Burnaby guy, right? So
yeah, I'm more of a Family Ties guy myself, but
you'll also like that, Alex P. Keaton.
Sam, what are you binge watching these days, or a movie recommendation?
We just finished the 7th episode of The Beast in Me, I think.
Beast in Me,
with,
right.
Claire Danes. And so we are, it's only 8. It's a short one. So I'll let you know, but it's
really good. I heard that's incredible. I heard she's like this huge standout role for her. Everyone talks about how amazing she is in that.
It's really good. It's really good. Totally recommend it.
New Year's resolutions, we'll timestamp this February 4th. Most of them are, you've quit,
I've broken all of them.
Are you not sticking with any?
I said no more YouTube episodes, but you know.
Yeah.
No, I got nothing. No.
All right.
Something you've bought for under $1,500 that's had a positive impact on your life.
I can't do Lululemon pants again. So, I actually got a new tennis racket. So, there you go. That's,
And it wasn't from a garage sale. I remember this.
you were the last guy we knew still playing with a wood racket. So, this is exciting.
I was using my neighbor's 90-year-old neighbor's racket. So I decided to buy a new one. So
it's funny I've seen it in various places in the tennis community. The guy who shows up with really old gear and is really good, they call it raw dogging. And you are the ultimate raw dog. I feel like that's like a Winnipeg trait. No bad.
You know, why it ain't broke.
last but not least, it can't be Taylor Swift. What are you listening to these days? What's on repeat in the car?
I did a ski trip last weekend, and it was with a bunch of guys who are sort of our age, and we were listening to Tribe Called Quest the whole way there. So
ooh, that's a good one.
You know, a blast from the past. But
amazing. Well, Sam, thanks again for taking the time today. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Good to see you guys. Thanks a lot.
there you have it, folks. Our discussion with Vancouver lawyer and friend of the show and friend of ours, Sam Adkins.
You know, always great to hang out with Sam on or off the air. So yeah, just good to see him. And super bright guy, super balanced. I love how he approaches this, obviously, from a place of rational thought and calmness, which can't be said for everybody in BC.
That's right. Cannot be said for everyone. The New Brunswick Court of Appeal is a very interesting development, and it will be interesting to watch how this plays out. But yeah, any kind of certainty is what we need. And
totally.
And I guess we're moving slowly along towards some sort of resolution. So maybe we'll have Sam back on with future developments. But what else do we have for the day, Adam? Well, you've been doing a lot of work on Instagram. What is the handle?
Yeah, if you do want to tag along with our real estate journey here in Vancouver, we post our sales, our listings, a little bit behind the scenes of what's happening with the podcast.
Some of the clips from the podcast.
We post clips from the podcast, some of them before the podcast is actually even out. We also are updating people when new shows are live. So yeah, and I mean, really just giving more thoughts about the market in general. So definitely check us out on Instagram. Head over there. It's at Vancouver Real Estate Podcast. And then, of course, you know, you said this last week, but I just wanted to echo this. We've worked with, you know, a ton of people, a ton of great people over the years from this podcast. And we'd love to continue to do so. We really value everybody in the VREP community. So if you want to, if you're thinking of buying or selling this year, that's what we do. That's what we specialize. So feel free to reach out. And if there's something outside of the Lower Mainland that we can't help you with, we know the best people out there that we can connect you with. So feel free to reach out at any time. And Matt, how can people get in touch?
You can try me at any time, 778-847-2854 or matt@vancouverrealestatepodcast.com.
Or you can try me at 778-866-4574 or adam@vancouverrealestatepodcast.com.
And of course, we got that nonpartisan line, info@vancouverrealestatepodcast.com.
Well, have a great week, and we'll see you next week. Another great episode.
It's going to be a good one. Have a great week.
2,000 Spaces for Radio. Subscribe today.